You know, when we look at the long history of Black Palestinian solidarity in this country, you know, from Birmingham to Bethlehem, I think is an amazing sort of slogan to put it together, because Birmingham as the crucible of the civil rights movement and Bethlehem as the crucible in many ways of the liberation theology tradition that the civil rights movement was based on, and to see these abuses, this apartheid, this occupation happening in historic Palestine, creating a strong cultural connection and reality to that history and that rhythm and that spirit of the Black Liberation Movement, the Palestinian Liberation Movement, organizationally and at the grassroots, because it speaks to the similarities of the struggle. It speaks to the similarities of the reasons why we're both in oppressed situations. It speaks to the reality of the world today.
That's Eugene Puryear, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Eugene Puryear, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, part one of a special two-part program. From Birmingham to Bethlehem, two iconic places saturated with meaning. As segregation and Jim Crow were described as intractable, so too is Palestine today. How can the Palestinian struggle for freedom and dignity take lessons from the Black Liberation Movement? Historical circumstances are clearly different, yet there are similarities. Both are located in a colonial-like situation, where a powerful oppressor dominates another less powerful group. Racism is a major factor. The Black Liberation Movement and Malcolm X's eloquent voice and militant politics resonate with Palestinians struggling for their freedom. Liberation struggles are not easy. Resistance to change is entrenched. Power does not readily give up its prerogatives. Our guest today is Eugene Puryear. He's a journalist, activist, and public speaker. He's a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And he's the host and producer of Breakthrough News.
Now, I've actually talked about Black Palestinian solidarity many times before during Black History Month over the years, but it's never felt so poignant as our current moment. And it's a long history, and it's a deep history, and it has deep connections to the undercurrents of both struggles, what they're really both about in their core essence. Two oppressed people trying to find a way to overcome their neocolonial, colonial overlords who have imposed upon them for decades, and in the case of the Black Liberation Movement, centuries, a certain form of living, and denied their humanity and denied its reality. And when you start to look at the history of Black Palestinian solidarity, it's interesting to see how it starts to come to be in a major way. I mean, you know, one of the most major figures talked about today in Black History Month is always Malcolm X, right? Well, Malcolm X was really one of the first individuals to try to build a strong bridge between the Palestinian Liberation Movement and the Black Liberation Movement in an organized sense. And it was part of his own development of his own consciousness as he starts to move in beyond the Nation of Islam. He starts to become an independent activist. He forms the Organization of African Unity, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, and he's trying to establish a different sense of what Black politics really means. And his basic understanding was that the situation of Black people in America was that of an internal colony, a nation within a nation, that the struggle of Black people was for liberation. It wasn't a struggle for democratic pluralism, that Black people were excluded from the body politic on purpose, that they were not allowed to ascend into the political structure in any significant way on purpose. It wasn't just a holdover of something that happened 300 or 400 years before, although that is where it started. His understanding was that there was a very particular reason why Black people in America were at the are disproportionately at the bottom of everything, which continues to be true today. It's an amazing thing when you think about it, really. I mean, poverty, unemployment, diabetes, hypertension, people being killed by the police, people going to jail. We could go on probably all night and just talk about that. If it's bad, it's disproportionately Black and indigenous. And that, of course, is because of the roots of what has brought us to this point. Ultimately, you had a situation in the United States, or at that time, previously the United States, the colonies, whatever you want to call them, at that moment, where those enterprises were more or less failed institutions. You know, they thought they were going to come here and they were going to do a lot. It wasn't working out. People were dying. People were leaving. They had to try to find a way to create a certain level of dynamism. And they're searching for this. They're searching for that. I mean, the whole reason they came here originally, or at least, you know, some of them, some, I guess, to escape, you know, religious X, Y, and Z. But a lot of people thought they were going to find gold. And that's why they thought it was going to be, you know, very lucrative for them. This is actually why Columbus even came in this direction, the original point. But that being said, they thought similar, like the British colonies, like the Spanish, they'd find some natural resources and that would help them. Didn't work out, or maybe they'd find some other, you know, furs, different pieces like that. Wasn't really a major industry. But they were able to figure something out over time, and that was they figured out how to deal drugs. And I say that very directly, because ultimately the narrative of how you describe something determines ultimately how you view it. And of course, in our civics class version of American history, it was freedom, justice, democracy, all these different things, which didn't really exist in any significant way at the time. But if that's the narrative of what took place, it gives you a very different framing for the reality of how and why the country was founded. But ultimately, what gave the dynamism to what would become the United States was the fact that, at least initially, they found sugar and tobacco. Now, sugar, of course, and this maybe tells you something too. We don't even think about it as a drug now because it's in everything. Sugar's all over the place. But as I've said a few times before, you know, anyone here who's a parent, there's a reason why you don't constantly give your kids cookies, because you understand not only the impact on their health, but also the fact that it starts to, you know, it builds on itself, that it becomes an addiction, and it starts to become something that you have to have all the time. And ultimately, all these products, Coke, Pepsi, Oreos or whatever, I mean, everything around us, even the coffee industry are really based on this. So we can see it even in our own lives today and in the way that it operates. But certainly then it was a little bit more of a revelation, because back then many people in Europe did not have access to sugar. It was like a luxury good. And this was the first opportunity that, you know, other people had the opportunity to have a little bit of a sugar high, if you will, in their daily lives. Same thing with tobacco. You smoke it, you get high. You know, this is, you know, just out of feudalism Europe. It's not like people are living high quality lives by and large. So if you know, can drink a little something, smoke a little something and feel a little bit more calm, you can see that there's a certain value in that. And it creates a constantly expanding market. And in the context of that, you have to find a way to get people to work, to continue to grow the way you're doing these crops, these plantations and different pieces. And they had a lot of different ideas about how that could potentially take place. The indigenous people, they were first going to try to enslave them. Didn't work out the way they expected. Not only did the indigenous people resist, but, you know, listen, this was their land, their territory. The people who lived there were like them. So it was much easier for them to run away, in addition to just straight up resistance. You know, you enslaved me, you put me here, you say you're working here, well, I go 50 miles away. Who's gonna know the difference? Who's gonna be able to find me? So that doesn't work, you know, right off the bat. They didn't say, well, let's get indentured servants over here. We got a lot of poor, destitute people in Europe. A lot of them were putting in prisons, debtor prisons, by the way. Georgia, the state of Georgia, this is an interesting fact maybe that you'd be curious in. The whole basis of Georgia was to bring poor whites out of debtors' prisons to keep a buffer between Florida and South Carolina, because the Spanish were allowing escaped slaves from South Carolina to form a militia and go and raid the slave plantations in South Carolina and free the slaves and create a lot of damage. But nonetheless, they said, we're going to bring people over here. You know, we're going to sell them a good story, a good song. You come for 10 years, 20 years, you know, you get a little bit of land. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. All of that also false. And, you know, a lot of times people died before the, you know, the term was up because the conditions of existence were so bad. A lot of times you would get here and you're here now. So what are you going to do? And they would just say, oh, well, you know, you had 10 years, but look, you know, we gave you food, we gave you this, we gave you that. You're gonna have to go for another 10 years. So it becomes almost a form of kind of perpetual slavery. And some of the early indentured servants, by the way, were coming from Africa before the establishment of slavery. So then they even have an even bigger problem, because what takes place is you have these indigenous people who are trying to defend their land and carve out, you know, their own existence in this new reality with all these people coming from Europe trying to kill them and destroy them in every possible way. You've got a number of very angry individuals who've been brought to the country allegedly as servants, but they're basically in a form of servant, you know, almost slavery in a sense. And they're certainly not getting anything like what they thought they were going to get when they were, you know, sold a bill of goods and brought over here. And then they start to work together. And they figure, well, there's more of us than these plantation owners and these others that are going on, so we can wage our own form of resistance. So now you've got the opposite problem of what you were hoping for. You wanted a stable labor force, but you got a bunch of angry people who would rather overthrow you and find a way to live amongst themselves without you, and they're not really concerned about your plans and the budding industries that you're bringing forth, insurance, shipping. And this is, you know, you hear it a lot when you talk about black reparations, but it's true. You can easily find it. There would be no banking and finance. Like, why are there deep capital markets in America? Slavery, 100%. Why do you have all this massive insurance industry? Slavery, 100%. The modern timber industry, we could be here all night talking about that, but I won't. But the basic point I'm making is this is the genesis of African slavery in America, because they figured we have to find some group of people who we can get over here and make work to keep this expanding economy going, but we have to be able to control them. So you bring people from across the ocean, so you've completely ripped them away from their context, and you know you're not going to swim back, so what are you going to do once you're here? You're trapped. So you've got a captive people, a captive nation. You brought them from dozens of different people from all across the African continent. So not just have you ripped them from their land, you've ripped them from their entire social context, which means that they now have to band together. But since they're under your purview, you have more control over the language they speak, the religions they practice, all of these different pieces. So you're able to have a large amount of control, not just over their workforce, but their spiritual and cultural life, so you can break people's resistance. I mean, that's what it's really about. And then, of course, you pass the requisite laws, the first real laws that start to bring in what we might call segregation, color caste system, to really establish slavery. First, you cannot own guns. Second, you cannot own land. Third, you cannot have interracial marriages. So that way you preserve the ability to identify based on phenotype who people are, which is obviously a form of social control. You make sure they can't build up independent wealth because they have no land. And you make sure they can't defend themselves because they can't own firearms. So you have this overall system that becomes extremely profitable and actually becomes the pivot point for the rise of capitalism, not just in the United States, in the entire world. You know, Haiti at the time of the Haitian Revolution was actually the most profitable corporation on earth. More wealth was being produced in Haiti than all of the 13 colonies, the early United States, at that time. So it gives you a sense that this was really a huge economic pivot point to grow capitalism as a system. And then even when slavery was over, you have a country that says, well, listen, this was actually working really, really well for us. And it really is a great benefit to have a certain, you know, maybe minority, but numerically large group of individuals who we can pay basically nothing and treat very bad, and by that get sort of extra profits, extra money. It really can sort of juice our economy and allow us to go to even higher heights for this elite of capitalist individuals, which is why it's a long story. Reconstruction is defeated. But nonetheless, you know, you have this pillar of capitalism. It's not an extra, it's not an alternative. It's why, even though you've had a black president, you still have everything bad is disproportionately black. It's a feature, not a bug, of the US capitalist system. So this is what Malcolm X was starting to try to bring to the struggle. He said that our struggle is in some ways a struggle for democracy, but it's not really a struggle like, say, you know, the Irish becoming more integrated into America, or the Italians becoming more integrated into America, because their relationship to the country, especially whiteness, is very different. Our struggle is, in his feeling, more akin to the colonized people of the world and those who are fighting against neocolonialism, because their existence is the same type of existence that we have. Their very own oppression and colonization exist only for the benefit of a small number of, believe it or not, the same people in America and Europe who really want to get rich by controlling really the whole world, and by subjecting, you know, most of the colonized world to disproportionate forms of exploitation, as every other, you know, quote unquote worker, farmer, or peasant, or whatever. So somewhat similar to the United States. So in this understanding, one of the most important things for Malcolm X in terms of how the black liberation movement is going to move forward is it has to look for its natural allies. It has to find the other anti-colonial, anti-imperialist forces around the world whose story is similar on a narrative level, of course, and you could talk all day about how similar your struggle is to the others, but that has the same enemy because it serves the same purpose. So he very quickly starts to move in many different directions, but one of the main directions he starts to move is towards, you know, Middle East, West Asia, of what you might call then, because of course, you know, Egypt under Nasser and what was happening with Algeria, with the Algerian Liberation Movement, all these different pieces. This area of the world was really a cradle for anti-colonial struggle and resistance. And of course, Malcolm X is also a Muslim. And so he's looking to go to the traditional areas, also the heartlands of Islam, and make close connections between the Islamic world and the Black Liberation Movement. And so in the context of this, it starts to bring him into contact with the Palestinian people. He goes to Gaza in 1964, he meets with the top jurist of Gaza. People, maybe you've seen the photo of Malcolm X shaking hands with an imam in Gaza. That was the top jurist, the top judge of Gaza at that time. He meets with the early leaders of the PLO, which becomes Foreign Palestinian Liberation Organization in 1964, and starts to forge ties with them as well. And obviously, the natural rhythm is clear, because the nature of the Palestinian struggle is so similar. I mean, why is it? Why is it that Zionism is in this space? Because, you know, when Zionism first started saying we need to create our own country somewhere, at first they were going to go to Uganda, believe it or not. They were also thinking about Argentina as well. For various reasons, they thought both of those, it's not really going to work the way we want it to work. You know, and one being, and we can see this even now today, right? The narrative power of being able to connect to the stories of the Old Testament, the sort of historic reality of the Holy Land. It gives you sort of a narrative benefit there in terms of why you should be there and steal the land. And let's just be clear, the land is stolen. You know, in 1948, when they start, they own 6% of the land. They wage a war, kill 15,000 people, expel 750,000 others. Then they own 78% of the land. Well, that you stole the land. You didn't buy it. You took the majority of the land you didn't own. But why were they able to succeed is the real question. Because the desire of Zionism to have a homeland by picking this particular area of the world actually coincided with another very important motion. And that's in the post-World War I era, the desire of the British Empire to take over everything that had been controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Because the British Empire, you know, is the biggest empire, rule Britannia, England rules the seas. The sun never sets on the British Empire. So they see a big opportunity after World War I, along with France, but mainly the British, to take over the former colonial territories of the Ottoman Empire in this case, but also Germany in other cases, in order to increase their own power. And it's an important, you know, element, because not only is this just generally for thousands of years, right? This is the crossroads of the world. But beyond that, you're starting to also see the emergence of oil as a commodity. So there's a lot of, you know, key things. You got the Suez Canal, which of course the British have been working since the mid-1800s to control. You've got oil starting to emerge as a big issue here. But you have to be able to critically control the area. And again, this is the benefit of history and really going to the primary sources, because most of the Zionist leaders were very openly talking and writing about this at the time. They felt no compunction. But what they realized right away, and what they would say to themselves, is, listen, we could never really survive in this area. Like, we're not going to be able to steal the land and be a decided minority from, you know, hundreds of millions of people whose very aspiration at this time is to be free. I mean, why was it that you had the quote unquote Arab revolt at that time? Because you had people who were looking to leverage the British against the Ottomans to free the Arab nations so they could, you know, work on their own lives and improve their own situation. And so there's no way for Zionism to stay there and to say, like, yes, we're going to control this territory, unless, as they said, we have a real powerful friend. And you can't have a more powerful friend than the British Empire at that time. So, and America, of course, has just stepped right into that space. So ultimately, these two things coincide. And the British and the Balfour Declaration, and this is why we talk a lot about 1948, let's talk about 1917, 1918, 1919, 1920, and what the British did then. That's critically important to understand this. They say, okay, cool, sounds like a great idea to us. Because what they're saying to them is, look, if you back us, we will be the 100% backers of Britain and the West. I mean, this is the whole language they're using. They're saying we'd be a bulwark for Western civilization against Asian barbarism. That's how they talked. You know, now they say it's not racist in its roots. Well, go read what they were saying at the time and then tell me it's not racist. I mean, you can see what's happening now, but just look at how it started. In that context, you know, you have the emergence of this moment where the British decide to create this space where you're going to have this homeland. So this is the identification that Malcolm X and these early Palestinian leaders are making amongst each other, because they're able to see the similarities, very different stories in many ways, although similar sort of players when we're talking about these various imperial powers. But they could see a various similarity about how both sides had ended up in a pretty bad position, that they had basically ended up there because their oppression was extremely profitable for someone else, and that ultimately that someone else tended to be the same people. So that maybe if they found a way to get together against a common enemy, they could actually liberate themselves in a very profound way, because as isolated struggles, it would be difficult to break out. You know, it'd be easy to isolate. I mean, this is the essence of British imperialism, right? And all imperialism. The Romans used to say it, divide and conquer. That was their strategy. The British, when you read the colonial, if you go, it's actually interesting, if you want to ever do this research and you go to London, you can go to all the colonial office. It's very well, the records, very well kept. And they're talking about it. They're saying, we have to be, if we want to take over India and these other places, just like the Romans, divide and conquer. So, you know, the Palestinian Liberation Movement, the Arab Nationalist Movement, the Black Liberation Movement are all thinking at this time, we have to move closer together because they want us to be divided, whether it be language, whether it be religion, whether it be nationality and patriotism. And this is the essence of what Malcolm X is trying to say. If you count your struggle in the essence of American patriotism, you can't win, because it means that you're going to isolate yourself from your most natural allies around the world. So they start to come together in a much more profound way by recognizing these understandings. Malcolm X is, of course, brutally assassinated February 21st, 1965, Audubon Ballroom. We now know, and we knew then, but we now know the FBI, the NYPD coming together and doing their own divide and conquer of elements in the Black movement to make this possible. So that very hopeful moment is in some ways scattered, but in other ways starts to come together powerfully. 1966, especially 1967, because of the rise of what has been, you know, known in the literature as the Black Power Movement. And in this context, you have this understanding of Malcolm X's starting to become more generally diffuse amongst Black people in general. Because ultimately, the Southern Freedom Movement is able to win some huge victories. You know, the Voting Rights Act, you know, the integration of schools and education and public places and all these things. But nonetheless, it was easy enough for Black people to see that that was good, in many ways great, but it was deeply insufficient to actually become free, especially in the North, where there was never de facto de jure segregation, just de facto, which meant it was a lot harder to sort of dig up and make people think a little bit more about the systemic realities of racism and how, you know, it wasn't just a bug, it was a feature, and that you had to really start to address the system more deeply, what Malcolm X had been saying. So this starts to become a deeper part of the consciousness. And in 1967, and this becomes a big breakpoint, because of course by 67, the, you know, civil rights movement, the Black Liberation Movement, most of the entities and organizations are speaking out against the Vietnam War and also raising other issues that were happening, some that we've sort of lost, you know, the 1965 struggle in the Dominican Republic, the emergence of the Puerto Rican, or the reemergence, I should say, of the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement, you know, things that were happening all across the African continent. So you have this greater consciousness starting to arise among really the sort of broad base of Black people in this country about the sort of nation within a nation, the internal colony reality, the importance of making and building solidarity between other struggles against colonialism and imperialism, and again, basically the same people. You know, if you're living in Chile, Angola, Harlem, you know, Chase Manhattan Bank is definitely your enemy, right? So people can make these connections. So the 67 war then becomes something that you have no choice but to have a position on. But it's this huge moment. I mean, you know, you had the Suez Canal issue in 1956, but, you know, you have this massive emergence of Arab nationalism coming to the forefront. So this is a world historic moment in this region, which has become only more geopolitically significant because of oil, because of the rise of modern industry. So what position are you going to take? And many, not many, some individuals who were involved in the civil rights movement had some Zionist proclivities. So there was a fear of what you might lose if you take a strong position. Some didn't take as strong a position as I certainly might have liked. But even that has been, you know, manipulated. Dr. Martin Luther King, of course, is being constantly invoked by Zionists now. They had the Super Bowl ad with his aide you know, in there, Clarence Jones. I didn't even know he was still alive, but, you know, there it is. The only thing I heard him say in 25 years is to come out and be for Zionism. But the point being, you know, there's this whole thing that, like, Martin Luther King was for Israel. Now, I don't, that's a separate talk, but what's important, I think, in this understanding, especially in our current moment, is he said at the time that if there's going to be peace, that the Israelis have to give back the occupied territories of what we now know as the West Bank and Gaza. So he would never have the position that they're saying he had. But let's put that aside for now. But you have in the a lot of the grassroots, especially emanating from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, a different orientation. And SNCC, of course, had been really leading the grassroots struggle for voting rights all across the South. And just to connect some things, they're having an internal conversation. And this is an issue a lot of people don't really know about. But the internal conversation is enriched by one individual by the name of Ethel Miner. Ethel Miner had worked with Malcolm X for many years, from about 1962 into 1965. And after he's assassinated, she goes to work with SNCC. She's working on the newsletter, other sort of popular education initiatives that they had. And so when this moment comes, she's saying, we have no choice but to stand with the Palestinians. Like, this is not just about whether we get hit hard, whether we lose money or whatever. Just like we stand for Vietnam, just like we stand for the Algerians, just like we stand for Angola, this is a struggle of an oppressed people for liberation, and we have to stand with them as well. And she's very convincing, of course. They come out, they take a very bold position against Zionism, against the Israelis in the 1967 war, and they do lose a lot of money. They do become significantly more isolated, but the position itself is very popular. And it starts to become the mainstream position. It's taken up by the Black Panthers. It was taken up by the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, which was based in Detroit, which obviously has a large Arab American population, which also played an interesting role in that history. But there's a good book called Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, that speaks a lot about that, that's worth reading. And so you start to see suffused throughout the whole Black liberation movement, you know, A, the idea that Black people are an internal colony, a nation within a nation, that its struggle is anti-colonial and anti-imperialist, and that to be liberated, you do have to have solidarity across borders. And you have the particularity, of course, of the Palestinian struggle. So ultimately, you know, there's a lot of things happen. Ultimately, you know, there's the radical subset of the Black liberation movement is, you know, defeated, killed, imprisoned, co-opted, or whatever. But in the context of forming sort of a new Black politics, it's one of the phrases at the Times, moving from protest to politics, as Bayard Rustin would say, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus comes into being, and you have more Black people coming into political office. And in some ways, it's a contradictory phenomenon. But, you know, ultimately, you have a situation where these people are sort of setting themselves up as a separate from radicalism. Like, you can have a Black politics that isn't sort of a radical revolutionary politics, which is ultimately what almost all of Black politics was seen at that time and really was in its majority. But you can have some people who are working within the system, so on and so forth. But the proximity to the times of these great uprisings that have been taking place all across the country. I mean, you think about 1968, 125 uprisings in the country after the murder of Martin Luther King. Someone told me this story once. You drive up and down 95, you could see off of every exit, you know, the smoke that's rising from all of these places. You know, you think about how big of an impact Minneapolis had after George Floyd. Imagine that in 125 different cities across America. And so ultimately, you have to have a politics, even if it's mainstream politics, that is basically going to speak to the mass of the people. People are not going to vote for you if they think you're some sort of sellout, and if they think that you're somehow involved in the sort of broader motion of stripping radicalism from the broader context of the Black liberation movement. So I listed Congressional Black Caucus on purpose because some of these institutions start to become, inside of the American body politic, voices that are pushing what I would consider much more progressive positions, not just on Palestine, on Cuba, you know, on relations with the Soviet Union and detente, on, you know, different issues with Latin America, certainly vis-a-vis Africa and the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, and also for the recognition of the socialist governments in places like Angola and Mozambique as they start to come into being. But Palestine continues to be one of the key cornerstones of that understanding. So you have the Congressional Black Caucus, the major civil rights leaders. In 1979, there was an interesting moment where you had different leaderships or people vying for leadership of what you might call the civil rights, you know, legacy at that point. SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was Martin Luther King's organization. Jesse Jackson had started Operation Push at that time. And they were trying to, you know, kind of vie with each other about who was going to be like the top leader. So one of the aspects that took place is, you know, they wanted to show, you know, they were down with the politics. So there was a race between SCLC and Jesse Jackson to go to Lebanon to meet with Yasser Arafat and the PLO leadership. Like, they wanted to be the first people to get there, each side, to say, like, no, I'm the one who's really down with the Palestinians. You know, I was here first. I was talking to them. I'm with Palestine. But these are, like, you know, mainstream, big-time black leaders at the time. So it gives you a sense of the institutionalization of black and Palestinian solidarity built on the foundation of this mass struggle that started with Malcolm X and the Organization of African American Unity, suffused through the Black Panther Party and others, and became just a generalized understanding. So it's just a part of the game. It's a part of black politics. You know, there's going to be somewhat more pro-Palestinian views. And if you were like a black politician who was for Zionism, it was very strange.
You're listening to Eugene Per Year, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, part one of a special two-part program. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So to come back around to the point about black faces in high places, I think it puts it in a new context, you know, both generally and specifically towards Palestine. Because for America, they do this now. When they go around the world, doesn't matter what they're doing, they could just be massacring people left and right, but it's always for democracy. It's always for freedom. It's always for justice. The US is always right. Everyone else is always just some evil authoritarian, this, that, and the third. No matter how bad it looks on the forefront, we just have no choice but to kill these people because it's for democracy, right? But it's hard to sell that story to people around the world, because people around the world are very aware of the oppression of black people in the United States and also the genocide of Native Americans. I've had the privilege, the distinct privilege, to travel to many different corners of the earth, most of the continents, and I can tell you, no one is confused about that fact. It is a very well-known fact. So when you're trying to preach to other people and say, do X, Y, and Z because of freedom, justice, and democracy, people are going to say, well, why would I do that? Because you don't even practice it yourself. So who are you to tell me how I should be running my affairs? So ultimately, for the propaganda aspect of US imperialism, you have to try to address this Achilles heel that you have. And so one of the main ways to do that is blackface, because you're not going to actually do anything for black people. As I said, it's a feature, not a bug. And, you know, you can go across the whole spectrum. I think there are many people who are in mainstream politics or whatever who I think are against racism. But because they're unwilling to actually challenge capitalism and the foundations of racism and the actual construction of the capitalist system in America, they aren't actually able to advocate for solutions that meet the scale of the problem, that will really change the reality for black people in America. So absent that, you got to do something to at least make it look like you were not a racist. And so this becomes a big acceleration in the 90s. How do we get as many black people as possible in all these various institutions, even though the policies are going to be the same? And that's going to be very good for us because it's going to do two things. It's going to have people in other parts of the world maybe get confused, like, oh, okay, America, maybe they're actually doing something now. And also, it's going to help lend the moral authority of the black liberation movement to imperialism. Because inside of the United States, you know, it's always been the case that when black people rise up in a profound way, all sorts of people, oppressed and exploited people, start to rise up alongside of them. You know, in the 1967 Detroit uprising, which of course is emanating from the black community and about black issues, they later went back about a year later and they did a study of who was arrested for sniping at the cops. And interesting fact, more white people than black people were arrested for sniping at the cops. And it was because there were all these angry white people who'd come from Appalachia, who'd been promised these great factory jobs in the auto factories. It had definitely not worked out the way they thought they were going to. So when black people were like, yeah, we're rising up and taking everything down, they were like, you know what? We're coming with you, because this is our chance to make a move. And that's just one small example, but you can see this is the history, the civil rights movement, which catalyzes the modern movement for immigrant rights in the United States. I mean, that's what crushed the exclusionary policies of immigration with the Immigration Act of 1965, the politics of the civil rights movement and the context of it. The modern Native American movement, which arises, many of the early individuals who would form AIM and other organizations coming out of the civil rights era, having worked together, the Chicano freedom movement, same thing, right? So you can see this motion, Reconstruction after the Civil War. It tends to be that the black struggle has a detonator effect, if you will, that sort of sets off a lot of different struggles and brings people up. So ultimately, if you can take the moral authority of the black liberation movement and associate it with Palestine, as it had been, obviously that's going to strengthen the struggle for solidarity with Palestine in the United States. Because people who may have some question, maybe don't know that much, are gonna say, well, hey, these leaders who I really respect from a struggle that I look up to are saying I should be working with these folks. So let me do that. But the reverse is also true, right? If you can take the moral authority of the Black Liberation Movement and attach it to imperialism and Zionism, it creates a space in people's minds that, you know, yeah, like maybe I should be for this. I mean, that's why the Super Bowl ad with Martin Luther King's aid was all about the struggle against racism. You know, it's all about being against hate. And, you know, I'm all against hate. You know, we should stop anti-Semitism. But this is just a smokescreen. But you can see the kind of moral authority, like, what, you know, Israel, we're the same. It's the same thing. You know, we're just trying to be against anti-Semitism. That's what Israel's about. You know, just like against racism. And so it starts to muddy the waters about what's really going on. And it makes the possibility of breaking the link of solidarity in this country a lot stronger. So there's a lot at stake, you know, when Linda Thomas Greenfield is raising her hand to veto these resolutions. It was amazing to me because all the people behind her were also black. I could be ignorant, but I feel very confident that everyone who works there is not black. And it seemed very specific that they get them all, the six of them they got are all lined up right behind her in the context of this, while the eyes of the world are on her holding up her hand for this veto to confuse people about what's really going on. And the number one level of confusion was to elect Barack Hussein Obama as the president of the United States. Because, you know, listen, we all remember, some of us, I'm sure, remember it, you know, the nature of that New Yorker cover, you know, with Barack and Michelle in the Oval Office dapping each other up, dressed like Black Panthers, whatever. I think she had like a gun, you know, over her shoulder. The very tone of it, I mean, you know, she and he, to some degree, they're from the South Side of Chicago, you know what I mean? And she has come from a long family, actually, in the South Side of Chicago. His name is Barack Hussein Obama. It was like all the sort of, you know, rhetorical, image-wise things about what you should be afraid of from black people, but like in a very acceptable way. So acceptable that they even had Joe Biden, like a racist, with them, you know? Like, and if he could be with it, like, we all can be with it, right? We forget that now because Joe Biden's whole thing is like, black people love me, let's see in November. But let's just remember, the whole reason he got picked in the first place is because black people did not love him. And that racist would be more likely to be like, okay, I'm sorry, Barack Hussein Obama, was he born here? I don't know, but he's got Joe Biden. And ultimately, this is the top imperialist position. So you put somebody in that position like that, it really starts to confuse people. And even the ones who aren't confused are in a position where it's like, well, what do I really say? Because obviously for the sort of cultural reality of America, to have a black person be the president is big. I mean, you know, no black people thought that was possible. For sure. And if you did, it was like you were just saying it just to say it. But that's why Colin Powell, who is, you know, a big imperialist. White people love Colin Powell. He's so well-spoken. He didn't run when they wanted him to run in 96 because he was like, come on, this is the United States of America. I can't win. So even someone who was like had every respectability checkmark was like, it can't be done. So ultimately, it's, you know, people are looking at that thinking, well, do I want to be the person talking down on that, right? So let me just maybe mute my criticism a little bit or try to find some way to kind of twist it or maybe blame someone under Obama and not really come at him. So you have the water starting to get muddied significantly, specifically to break that link. And to sort of bring it to a close, I think this is what's so important about having the conversation about black and Palestinian solidarity right now. Because the struggle that's taking place in general, but certainly within the black community, is very much over this question of what black politics really means, what it really should be, what its content actually should consist of. And you have the, you know, forget Obama now, he's gone, but, you know, the Hakeem Jeffries of the world, who had the nerve to go to a pro-Israel rally in 2014 and quote George Wallace, you know, it's really hard to fathom. Like, if you know anything about his district, like this is like the blackest part of Brooklyn where definitely people are not really rocking with Israel. And he's become one of like the most pro-Israeli voices, right? So you have these people who are out there, you have all the individuals dealing with Biden, Clyburn, and all these other people. And they're saying that being in solidarity with this genocide is the essence of black politics. But on the same token, you have a powerful grassroots uprising that is challenging that in a profound way that they don't even know how to deal with. I mean, you can see the African Methodist Episcopal Church, now one of the main religious institutions of the black community, whose very existence is a protest in and of itself against the racist white churches, has now passed a resolution not just to have a ceasefire, but to end U.S. aid to Israel. And this is the same denomination that Biden went to Emmanuel AME Church in South Carolina and spoke at and was protested, and people said, oh, it was so bad. This was so disrespectful. It was so disrespectful that the church father said, no, we actually agree with the protesters, not the president. We're seeing with young people in the country, I mean, you know, Charles Blow from the New York Times had two separate editorials, op-eds, about this issue of black Palestinian solidarity. The first one, which kind of caught a lot of you know, people were paying attention to it. The second one didn't get as much, but the second one was more interesting because he said, I had to write about this again because the response was so deep, like the depth of anger amongst young black people towards Joe Biden because of the genocide in Gaza was so deep, I actually wanted to go back and interview more people because it was more profound than I thought. And I can say, as I was reading it, I was pretty surprised because I can say, you know, I lived in DC for 15 years. A lot of these people were sort of like Democratic Party operatives. I don't want to say any names, but a lot of these names, I was like, damn, really? Because they were the type of people who really never took any bold stance because they didn't want to mess up their potential job opportunities in the next Democratic administration. Like, so people who, you know, I might actually call them sellouts, quite frankly. And I did, some of them. And here they are, like, yeah, like, we can't vote for this cat. Like, this is too much. He's gone too far. So you have this also happening at the same time. And so you have this really profound moment that's taking place where this axis of black Palestinian solidarity is reemerging at a powerful moment in history. Because another connection in this moment, and this is why I wanted to start where I started with the history, because what's happening in Palestine is so critical for the entire globe right now. Not just from a moral perspective, but from a strategic perspective. Because what's taking place is the United States is facilitating this genocide to facilitate the so-called pivot to Asia, talking about Obama, to isolate China. Because the United States is losing dynamism. The economy, I know they tell you it's good, it's not. One of the biggest problems they have is other countries have developed their own economies. And they're starting to say, like, you can't just set the terms of our exploitation and our oppression the way you want. At the very least, at least give us some say in our own exploitation. At the highest level, it's like we refuse to be exploited and oppressed by you anymore. So the ability to continue to disproportionately hold down the formerly colonized worlds is slipping away from them. And China is the key to that. It's a whole broader conversation, but ultimately that's why they're saying that they're gonna go to war. This is what the Pentagon's saying in the next 5 years. It's gonna be a war between the US and China, or at least we should expect it. The Marine Corps is saying we're changing everything we're doing because we have to be able to survive a nuclear conflict. So in their mind, this is what they're preparing for. Like, it's not, they're not playing. They really think, yeah, if we have to, we'll go to a nuclear conflict. But ultimately, if you wanna take all your military power, you can only do but so many things at one time. So you got to get out of the Middle East, where you have everybody now, but that's still crucial. It's the crossroads of the world. It controls all the oil and gas going to Asia, which are all the biggest rising powers. And don't get confused. Even if the U.S. says, that's my friend, they don't just ride on friendship. They want to make sure that if you decide not to be their friend, that they can choke you out. So definitely, if you can take these rising economies and say, we have the military force to control basically everything you are doing, then it's a powerful weapon. You can't just leave. You can't just be like, all right, you know what? Y'all do your thing and move on. Because if you do that, the people of the area are going to be like, okay, great. If we do our thing, it's going to be very different from how you wanted us to do it. And you're not going to have the same level of control. And it's going to further erode and keep this trend going of declining power. So in order to check that, you have to find a way to keep your basic writ there. Keep the basic bargain that the British first made of having Israel as this central piece that is going to be able to continue to push forward the interest of these Western powers. Can't do it alone. You're saying you want to leave, so you have to create a normalization process where you get the most reactionary Arab regimes to work with Israel to keep anyone who wants to be too independent in check. So then you can move right over there to China and either kneecap them or end up in a nuclear war. So that's why Biden is facilitating the genocide, because it helps them. Every story that is out there that Biden is pressuring Netanyahu is fake. It's fake. I guarantee you, it's fake. I mean, not even just like distorted, it's fake. This is good for them. And we have to push back on that. Just because it's in the New York Times doesn't mean it's true. Nothing about what they're doing suggests that they're pressuring anyone. You can't say, please stop doing this, and here's $700 million worth of weapons right. to do it. It just is not realistic.
Yeah.
So ultimately, when you look at what's taking place, the Biden administration, I think, is like, okay, this is actually great. One, this huge amount of violence towards the Palestinians, maybe we'll be able to do something that we've never been able to accomplish, and that's crush the will and the capacity of the Palestinians to resist. Now, we know that they have completely failed in that task, but that's why they're facilitating it to have it keep going. Because the idea is like, well, we'll just kill enough of them, eventually they won't be able to fight back, and we'll be able to impose the solution that we want. Secondarily, you know, Israel, it was already losing some shine. It was already becoming pretty discredited. You could see the rise of people, BDS, other things like that. Israel has never been more isolated and discredited in its entire existence than now. Countries and people and organizations who went far out of their way to never take a position on the Israel-Palestine conflict are now taking a position, and oftentimes at least in soft solidarity with the Palestinian people. So you've got this challenge that means that the U.S. can impose upon them even more. Because they can say, well, look, if we leave, y'all are falling tomorrow. Like, look how what's going on right now. So ultimately, they can impose the solution that they want on the region, on both parties, through the agency of this genocide. So it's strategic. They're doing it on purpose because they know what's going on. And they also understand that this is a process that really is affecting certainly the entire world. It's affecting the United States. I mean, you think about, you know, as Martin Luther King said, the bombs exploding in other communities, in other countries, exploding in my own community. I mean, we can see that now, how the military-industrial complex is draining the life from this country in order to drain the life from other peoples around the world so a handful of people can make a whole lot of money. Well, ultimately, at the end of the day, one of the biggest challenges they have then is if that Achilles heel comes back. And if the Black Liberation Movement stands in solidarity with the Palestinian people in a strong way, that all progressive people in the United States are going to say, yeah, we need to stand on this square. We need to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. And it starts to become an obstacle. It starts to become an obstacle to achieving the goals that are in the survival of the rich and the elites. So this struggle is existential between the two. And it's why what we do right now is so important, because any little piece of space we can give to the Palestinian people, any way we can sort of declaw to some degree the U.S. imperialist reality, it's not just the freedom of the Palestinians, it creates space for the freedom of people all around the world. And if they're allowed to break the main axis of solidarity in this country that makes people want to stand with Palestine, they will be able to choke out more of the entire world. So that's why this history is so important, because it's playing out in a contemporary way that however it ends up will be one of the key determining factors over whether the rest of this century and probably the next century is going to be a century where we have more justice, more equity, where we address climate change, where we deal with poverty, where we deal with hunger. Are we going to do that? Or are we going to keep going the way we're going right now, which I think is the wrong direction? I mean, those are really the stakes that are on the table. That's really the context and the essence of what's happening right now in this country. I think that's what's so important about Black and Palestinian solidarity beyond just its own history and its own importance to both communities, is the strategic role it plays in the broader struggle for making the world much more just, much more fair, and I think much better. So I'll just end there, and thank you so much for coming out. I really appreciate it.
Talk about Edward Said's book, Orientalism, and the concept of Islamophobia.
Islamophobia today is in many ways sort of a form of Orientalism. I mean, you have to read the book. The basic sort of thrust of what Dr. Said is trying to put out is that there is sort of this othering of people in the formerly colonized world, this exoticizing of them in a certain way that also results in a certain level of demonization and preconceived notions about who they are, but about the nature of their culture. You know, the idea that like those people tend to be like this, and that sort of governs really the entire discourse in the West over how these places are approached. So that when you want to cover the Middle East, you're just bringing in certain notions ahead of time, because that's how those people are. And certainly I think we see this in the context of Islamophobia, in the context of what's happening in Palestine, one being that, you know, they're just like naturally violent people, and that there's something about the long history of tribalism and Islam and other things that have, you know, led them to have a certain element to their culture that is this, that, and the third. And I think that the way that it plays out here today continually is these sort of racist notions seep in. And they see, I think the way it's most notable is in the small ways. Like when people come out and say things that are very racist, it's like very obvious. And I think this is one of the elements of Orientalism is that, you know, that is easy to kind of dismiss. But when it's sort of couched in sort of what might be called a learned guise, right? Where it's sort of based on your deep knowledge of the region. Because notice how all these Western journalists, you know, that are always reporting, and academics, you know, that have the deep knowledge of the region. They've reported from there for 30 or 40 years. But their ultimate conclusions always end up in this idea that somehow there's some othering thing about them that you can't understand. Everything else, like, they're not really like us in that way. And I think that we've done so much since 9/11 to create this reality in the Arab and Muslim world that somehow they're just, like, not really like us. Like, you know, democracy doesn't really come naturally to these people, right? I mean, if you look at the history of their empires and they may be great and they may be this, but, you know, they didn't have the same democratic enlightenment traditions that we had, and that continues to affect their ability to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, all these so-called learned and intelligent analyses that are really deeply rooted in a form of racism. And I think that's why that book had such a huge impact when it came out in the late 70s and the 80s, because it was revealing how so many of the received wisdoms and received truths were based on these you know, basically like British colonial office formed ideas of what it meant to be an Arab or a Muslim or an Indian and how those interacted. You know, I mean, they used to say there is no India, right? It's just a bunch of different types of people, and you have to understand their characteristics and be able to put the, and this is the rationale for the British Empire. So I think we're in a similar moment where the empire is rationalizing its existence by creating narratives about people that, you know, maybe rooted in some level of fact or truth, but is really designed to create an othering in your mind that they are different from us, that they're like a different form of humanity, that it's hard to really understand them, and that the things we hold dear, they do not hold dear, right? Like, I mean, you know, here's one. People in the Arab and Muslim world don't support women's rights. Strange thing for America to be saying.
Right.
You know, I mean, a country that is basically based on selling women on the auction block to sell commodities is saying that some other group of people is like, yeah, they just don't believe in women's rights. But that's like axiomatic. It's axiomatic, you know, that if you wear a hijab, that you must be oppressed, right? I mean, that's axiomatic. It's true. If you, any major newspaper, that's what they think. That's what they teach you in school. And if you say that you're not, well, you're just brainwashed. Or, you know, if they're interviewing you in that country, you're worried you're gonna be assassinated or killed or whatever, so you can't speak freely, right? I mean, these are the things that people don't even question when they come up as mainstream media narratives. No one even looks at the reality of the United States. No one ever really asks that if the only way to make it in Hollywood as a woman is to get naked on film if somehow you don't have agency. No one ever really thinks about that. Or if Hollywood doesn't respect women's rights. Or if America doesn't respect women in its essence. No one ever says that, right? But if you wear a hijab, you must be oppressed. No one ever interrogates it, and that lack of interrogation creates the space to kill people. Because when you can other someone, and when you can think they don't value what you value, that they're somehow a little less human than you are, it's a lot easier to kill them. That's why in every single war, you know, whoever the enemy is, there's some slur that you refer to them as, because it helps dehumanize them. Because, you know, killing is bad. People don't really want to kill people, other people in general. It's something that, you know, you have to have a reason to do it. And so they create this sense, and we've created this sense that has made it so easy to wage these wars all around the world and to assume people are evil, you know? If you just say, Assad is evil, okay, case closed. Iran is evil, case closed. Palestine, Hamas, evil, case closed. I mean, the fact that there's no facts about like 90% of what they're saying about Hamas, but people are still like, well, I mean, it's Hamas, right? It's Hamas. But no one is ever saying that about the United States, who's killing way more people than Hamas has ever dreamed of killing. The number of people Hamas has killed compared to the U.S. government is no competition. But there's no thought that America is teaching its children to hate. No one says America has this genocidal intent to destroy all people. And it doesn't even make sense. But again, when you have this concept, this othering, this orientalized spirit, it becomes easy to continue to repeat these things. And, you know, as it's been said before, if you repeat a lie enough times, it becomes the truth. And I think that's a lot of what's happening right now. But I know my chair is on me now. We're going to stop there. Yeah. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out. I really appreciate it. Great conversation.
You were just listening to Eugene Puryear, From Birmingham to Bethlehem. Eugene Puryear is a journalist, activist, and public speaker. He's a founding member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and he's the host and producer of Breakthrough News. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Medea Benjamin, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Eugene Per Year, From Birmingham to Bethlehem, Parts 1 and 2, and for the classic Howard Zinn book, A People's History of the United States, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Hep Ingham, Terry McRae, and KGNU. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bob Dylan singing Blind Willie McTell.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem, I traveled through East Texas, where many martyrs fell, and I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell. Well, I heard that hoot owl singing as they were taking down the stars above the barrier.